So let's start. So last time we were considering we were adding interactions. So at cubic order, this was our general possible interaction term, and then high order stuff. And we have these three possible coefficients. And we did the Strückelberg replacement. And we looked for the various scales that the terms would be suppressed by. And we saw that the lowest scales are the ones that come with the scalar self-interactions. So cubic terms in phi came with this scale lambda 3. Quartic terms came with lambda 4. And all the scalar self-interactions had scales that were, so this was lambda 5. Lambda 4, all the scalar self-interactions came with powers that were less than lambda 3. And then at lambda 3, the terms that we could have are interactions between a single power of the tensor and any number of power of the scalars, and terms with two powers of the vector and any number of the scalars. And then there was this one oddball term at the scale lambda 4, which has one power of the vector and any number of the scalars. And then we asked, what can we do to raise the cutoff beyond the lambda 5, which is the generic value you get for generic coefficients? And to raise that, we had to cancel off the self-interactions of phi by choosing these coefficients so that the phi terms appear in total derivatives. So these possible interaction terms give rise to phi self-interactions of this sort. And we saw that if we choose the coefficients to be minus 2 and plus 3 here, then this cancels into a total derivative. The phi self-interactions vanish, and we will have raised the cutoff to lambda 4. Okay, now we want to argue that we can do this to all orders, that all the phi self-interactions can be canceled. And for that, we will need to know about the general pattern of these total derivative combinations. So if we consider products of this matrix of second derivative combinations of the field, it turns out that at each order in phi, there's exactly one product of these combinations, which is a total derivative. Okay, so if we define this matrix pi just to be the second derivative of the field, we can write down this combination, which I'll call Lagrangian n total derivative, which will have n powers of phi. And it's going to be this combination. So there's this tensor. This tensor here is just the antisymmetric combination of a product of a bunch of etas. So the sum over all permutations The sine of the permutation like so. So this is nothing but just the antisymmetric combination of all these etas. And then we contract this up with a bunch of these pis. Like so. Okay, so this combination is a total derivative, because if I take one of the derivatives on this pi here, I can just pull it completely out, and it will vanish against all these other pis because of the antisymmetry of the eta symbol. Okay, so just to write out the first few of these, so L1 is the trace of pi, so I'll use the brackets to denote the trace. So this is just the box phi term. L2 is pi squared like this, which is this combination L3 is the combination that appeared here for the cubic terms. And then similarly, you get combinations at each order in phi. The thing to notice is that L sub n is identically zero if n is greater than the dimension of the spacetime, because you can't antisymmetrize more indices than there are dimensions. So we get an expression which is just identically zero if we write this out in dimension, if we write more fields than there are dimension. These are also known as the characteristic polynomials. These are the things you get if I take the determinant of 1 plus this matrix and I expand it out in powers of pi, you will generate these terms. And this term, this series truncates at LD, which is the statement that a matrix satisfies its own characteristic polynomial. Yes.
Is there a typo in lambda 3? 2 and 3 would be switched compared to this expression over here.
Did I get it wrong here? No, I think that's okay. I think it's okay, because this here is, what I mean by this is the trace of this as a matrix cubed, which is what this means here, the trace of the cube of that matrix.
But the coefficient is 2.
Oh, sorry, I got the coefficients backwards, yes. Which is which here? 2, it's wrong here. It should be minus 3. Plus 2, I think. Yeah, okay. Okay, so at each order in pi, we have one of these combinations. So if we just choose the potential at that order to be that particular combination, we will have canceled the scalar self-interactions. Okay, so our choice of the interaction is the sum, some coefficient C sub n times the total derivative combination of H mu nu. Okay, so C sub 1 here it would be just a tadpole term, so we'll set that to zero if we want to be expanding around flat space. C sub 2 is nothing but the Fierz-Pauli mass term. That's the combination that we would get up here. This relative minus 1 sign was the Fierz-Pauli combination. So if we set this to 1, then m will be the mass. And then this series truncates at n equals d because the higher polynomials all vanish. So it means that we have d minus 2 parameters in the interaction. So in four dimensions, we'd have a two-parameter family of these theories, which is which has the higher lambda 3 cutoff. Okay, we can now, so we've canceled all the scalar self-interactions. Let's go back and look at these interactions that occur at lambda 4, which involve one power of the vector and any number of powers of the scalars. So lambda 4 terms. If we look at this total derivative combination and look at terms where there's one power of dA, the term is going to look like this. There's one instance of d mu a nu, and then the rest are all scalars. Okay, and we can immediately see that this term now is a total derivative, because I can take this derivative on A and integrate it by parts onto everything else, and it will vanish due to the antisymmetry of the eta symbol. So this term is a total derivative and can be ignored. Which means that we've succeeded in eliminating all the possible interactions below this scale lambda 3. And we now have a theory with lambda 3 as the cutoff. Okay, so now we have to look at all the interaction terms that are appearing as lambda 3, since that's our new cutoff. And then we're going to take a decoupling limit that kills off all the stuff higher than lambda 3 and allows us to see the physics of the theory that's going on at this particular scale. Okay, so the lambda 3 terms were all terms with one power of h, and any number of powers of phi, and then terms with two powers of the vector and any number of powers of phi. Let's start by looking at these terms here, the h phi self-interaction terms. So we're going to take a decoupling limit again, just like we did in the case of the vector. So we're going to take mass goes to 0, M Planck goes to infinity with this scale lambda 3, which was this geometric mean fixed. Okay, if we look at the gauge symmetries in this limit, everything becomes the standard diffeomorphism symmetry for the H mu nu, and then the Maxwell gauge symmetry for A, and then the scalar is invariant. So it means that the terms that we find in the decoupling limit, these terms here, have to be invariant under this gauge symmetry, this linear gauge symmetry. No, so the shift symmetry falls off. So in the full away from the decoupling limit, phi transformed with this a shift by lambda to compensate, but it was proportional to m. Yeah, so in this limit, the scalar becomes gauge invariant. There's a residual of that, though, which is the fact that phi itself has to set, will have a global shift symmetry.
Oh, yeah, this is the shift symmetry that I'm talking about. Yeah, okay. It's still coupled on derivative, right?
That's right. The fact that it enters always with two derivatives means it always comes with this Galilean symmetry, okay. which is what we're going to see. Okay, so let's look at these phi h terms first. Okay, so this total derivative form for the Lagrangian, when we take the terms that have one power of h, we get terms like this. So let's pull off the h and write this as h mu nu times a tensor x, which contains n minus 1 powers of phi. And is defined as follows. So it's just, we just pulled off one of these pi's from the definition of the total derivative. So x mu nu is this tensor that looks like this. So the key properties of this are that x mu nu n, it vanishes identically if n is greater than or equal to d, just because the total derivative combination vanished identically. And it's identically conserved. So the derivative acting on this is identically zero. And that you can see just from the definition here, if I hit this with a derivative because of the antisymmetry of eta, everything vanishes, yes. Say, wait, what?
No, because should it be d minus 1?
Here?
When you saturate it?
No, just. The way I defined it, I've just, n is counts the number of fields there. So, yeah. Okay, so this identical conservation ensures that this decoupling limit Lagrangian is invariant under this linearized gauge symmetry. Because if I do a gauge transformation of here, h is invariant, phi is invariant, but the h transforms into this d mu c nu combination. And now this derivative, I integrate by parts. It hits against the x tensor, which vanishes identically. So it's invariant up to a total derivative under this under the required linear gauge symmetry and the decoupling limit. Okay. So I'll write out just the first few of these x tensors. So the first one is just eta, by definition. Oops, x0, x1 is this combination. And you'll recognize this combination as the thing which, when we were looking at the linear theory, this is what the combination that mixed with h mu nu. So this was this this mixing term between H mu nu and the scalar is just the quadratic instance of this decoupling limit Lagrangian. And then the higher ones are just generalizations of this. And you can check explicitly if you like that if you hit this with a derivative, it just vanishes identically. Okay, so we can write the scalar tensor part of our decoupling limit Lagrangian. For this lambda 3 theory. It contains the kinetic term, plus couplings to all these X tensors. And I've absorbed this should, there also has to be an appropriate power of lambda 3 here to make the dimensions right. Okay, so we now want to try to do our best to diagonalize these various contributions. So at the linear order, we could make this conformal transformation that would unmix the scalar and the tensor. We want to see how well we can do that now for these higher interaction terms. So let's take the example, the simplest example where we will be able to unmix everything is the case where only C2 and C3 are not equal to 0. So our decoupling limit contains a C2 term with an X1 and a C3 term with an X2. We can now use two identities which are satisfied by these X tensors. So if I take the linear Einstein-Hilbert operator, the guy that appears here, and I act it on phi times eta AB, what you generate is this first X operator. And this was what allowed us to do the conformal transformation at the linear level. This is just the conformal transformation. So when you do it here, you generate something which can cancel off this mixing. The next order version of that, if I do this operation on this tensor, I generate the X2. So by doing this kind of transformation, I should be able to arrange for it to cancel against this mixing. Okay, so the bottom line is that this implies that we can do a field redefinition. Where we take H mu nu and send it to some H mu nu prime plus C2 times phi eta mu nu plus C3 times this combination. And if we choose the numerical coefficients here and here correctly, we can arrange to cancel against these mixing terms in the Lagrangian. But when we do this, we also generate new terms. From the mixing terms themselves, we generate scalar self-interactions. Okay, so once we're done on mixing, the Lagrangian is going to look like follows. We have the kinetic term now in terms of this H prime. And now we have pure scalar self-interactions. Haven't been careful about the coefficients here, but some coefficient times a scalar self-interaction that looks like this, and another times a quartic scalar self-interaction that looks like this. Okay, so these scalar self-interactions are known as the Galilean terms. They're part of a larger family of such terms, which I'll write here. So L sub Galilean is the nicest way to define it, I think, is in terms of these total derivative combinations. So the n plus 1th Galilean can be written as phi times this total derivative combination of d d phi. So according to this definition, the first order one is just going to be a tadpole. The second order one is going to be equivalent up to integration by parts to the ordinary kinetic term. The third one is this cubic self-interaction. This here is the quartic one, and then so on. And then L Galilean, it vanishes for n greater than d, the dimension of space-time. So in four dimensions, you'd have up to a quintic, and that's it. And what we see here being produced in this decoupling limit are the cubic and quartic Galileans, and I also forgot there's a kinetic term here for the phi, which is the second Galilean. Okay, so the important properties of these Galilean terms are that they are ghost-free. The equations of motion are automatically second order, so we don't encounter any new degrees of freedom in this decoupling limit. And they're invariant under this Galilean shift symmetry. So so equations of motion are second order. Okay, so this is a non-trivial property because these Lagrangians are all higher derivative Lagrangians. Generically, you'd expect the equations of motion to be fourth order, but the terms are all structured in such a way that the higher order parts cancel from the equations of motion. So you get a theory that requires just the usual number of initial data to specify a unique solution, so there's no additional degrees of freedom beyond that of an ordinary free scalar. Okay, the other is this invariance under Galilean symmetry. Which is a shift of phi by a constant plus a shift by something linear in the coordinate. So x mu is the space-time coordinate, b is some constant parameter. And this is present here just from the fact that phi always appears in two derivative combinations. It started life by appearing always with two derivatives coming from the Stoeckelberg expansion. So it's automatically invariant under a symmetry that shifts the field or shifts the derivative of the field. And all the field redefinitions we made here didn't involve phi in any way. So the final Lagrangian still has to be invariant under this symmetry, but it's no longer strictly invariant because these terms here don't involve second derivatives of the field. There are terms here which involve only first derivatives. So it's non-trivial, the fact that it's actually invariant under this. It's invariant just under a total derivative. So actually, if you want to know more about these Galilean terms, they arise in other situations as well. This is just one place where they've been seen to arise. So my colloquium on Wednesday is going to be all about these Galileans. Yes?
Do you have an intuition about what that second shift? So the usual shift symmetry, we can say it's a pseudoscalar, some flat, some Goldstone boson.
Yeah.
Or phi. What does the second term do? Do you understand it? That's actually proposed. It looks like it's a fixed vector. It's translation to a fixed vector, right?
Yeah. One way to understand it geometrically is due to the Lorentz symmetry of a higher dimensional brain. So imagine we have like a membrane floating in five dimensions.
Yes.
There's going to be a symmetry associated with the boosts into the extra dimension, and in some appropriate limit, that symmetry looks like this. So you can think of this as like a shift, a translation into the other dimensions, whereas this is like a boost in the other dimensions. But, yeah, I'll talk more about that.
So this means that our world is embedded in this higher, so we can only understand that symmetry if our world is embedded in the higher dimensional world?
That's one way to understand it. I mean, the way it comes out of here, it has nothing really to do with that.
Extra dimensions, yes, exactly. So, yeah, but it looks like the construction does not need extra dimensions, so.
That's right, yeah. But that's just one.
One understanding.
One way to understand how this.
You don't have a 4D. This is what I want. You don't have a 4D of what it means.
Not really. I mean, not as nice as the 5D one.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, you should come on Wednesday if you're interested, because I'm going to say more about these. Okay, so the fact.
What happens when you couple it to matter? Can you couple it to matter?
Yeah, so you can couple this to matter, and you'll get, again, some. You know, so if you couple this to some conserved T mu nu,
yeah,
then when you do all these field redefinitions, you'll get some coupling between phi and the trace of T, which generates the fifth force, and then some higher order couplings from these other field redefinitions. It doesn't. To the extent that phi is non-dynamical, it doesn't. This
okay.
term.
So that means what does that mean? T, you mean you put a constant source?
If you just put a constant source, yeah.
So what happens if I put the particle?
You can.
Let's say I put loops. So let's say I calculate one correction to phi due to that coupling.
Yeah, so again, it's all surprised. But let me say it this way. So
yeah.
This is the linear. This was all built starting with the linear theory. You can't really couple linear gravity to a dynamical source. You need to consider the full nonlinear theory to do that. And when you do that, you will have to reintroduce the full diffeomorphism invariance, which I'll talk about next, which will give you, which will then automatically give you couplings that are consistent, so long as you take care to keep all the terms and Strickelbergs and so on that come from this matter coupling. Okay, so we found in the decoupling limit this Lagrangian that doesn't have an extra degree of freedom associated with it. This wouldn't be true if we started from one of these theories that didn't have the higher lambda 3 cutoff. If we didn't make this tuning to cancel off the scalar self-interactions, the decoupling limit would now just have some two derivative scalar self-interactions which don't have second order equations of motion. So this would be a manifestation in the decoupling limit of this so-called Boulware desert ghost, which is the statement that the full nonlinear Lagrangian has more degrees of freedom than the linear one. So let's go back to these interaction terms. So if I write just a generic old H cubed interaction without this specific tuning, this is now we've spoiled the linearity in H0, 0 which served as the Lagrange multiplier for this extra constraint that we needed. But now we see that if we use these proper total derivative terms, so if we choose L interaction to be these total derivative combinations, which when written out in terms of the eta symbol, were just this, we can now see basically by inspection that we will preserve the required constraints. This is automatically linear in H0, 0, because if I plug in H0, 0 for one of these H's, by antisymmetry of this eta symbol, every other index can now not be a 0, 0 index. So it's automatically linear in H0, 0. We automatically maintain the required constraints to eliminate the sixth degree of freedom. Okay, so this came for free, more or less. We'd found this theory by demanding that the cutoff be as high as possible. We didn't demand anything about extra degrees of freedom being gone or anything like that, but it comes out automatically once we raise the cutoff as far as we can. And that's reflected in the decoupling limit by the absence of the higher derivatives on the equations of motion for the Galois. Okay, so we've looked at the phi H interactions. Let's look now at the vector interactions. So these are the terms with two powers of A and then any number of powers of phi. And we know that from the decoupling limit gauge symmetries, these have to be invariant under the usual Maxwell gauge symmetry of A. So they should arrange themselves into terms which depend only on the field strength, F mu nu. And they do. If we look at this total derivative combination, in this case where we pick out only two powers of A and the rest phis, there's going to be two of these A terms which are symmetrized. And then the rest are phis. And by integrating by parts every which way and using the fact that this is antisymmetric, we can write this in terms of the Maxwell field strength. Which is manifestly invariant under the Maxwell gauge symmetry. And again, we can ask for the equations of motion, and they come out second order due to the antisymmetry of the epsilon again. And there are no higher derivatives in this sector. So this is kind of like a scalar tensor version of this Galilean. OK, so now in this lambda 3 theory, so we saw that in unitary gauge, if we compute this self-interaction of the gravitons, that there had to be a cancellation between the leading divergence in order to have this higher cutoff. And now in this way of writing the action, this is all manifest. So to calculate the scattering for the longitudinal gravitons using this representation, we would be drawing vertices from this cubic Galilean interaction. And these vertices, so these are these d phi squared box phi vertices. And now these go like, they manifestly go like the right power to give you the lambda 3 scaling that we want. This goes like p to the sixth over lambda 3 to the sixth without any special hidden cancellations. All the cancellations that are going to occur are now manifest. Okay, so that completes the toy version of the mass of gravity that is built off the linear theory. What we're now going to do is repeat the same story, but starting with the full nonlinear general relativity. Ask what interaction terms can I add to full general relativity that raise this cutoff to lambda 3, and what does that full theory look like? So any questions before I go on to that? Okay.
So you introduce this Galilean by trying to unmix the coupling between H and phi. You only did it for the case where C2 and C3 are not zero.
So I didn't mention. So if the other Cs are not zero, you can't completely unmix. There will be these, you'll have the Galilean terms, but you'll also have some unmixable interactions between the scalar and tensor. But they will still be ghost-free in the sense that there's no higher derivatives. It's just that they can't be decoupled in a local way. Okay, so now we go to the full case based on Einstein's theory, which is known as the DRGT theory. Okay, so our starting point now is going to be full Einstein-Hilbert action for the metric G, which now has full diffeomorphism invariance. And we're going to ask, what kind of potential can I add, which I'm going to write as a function of H mu nu, the metric deviation from flat space, and eta, the flat space metric. So we're going to write potentials that depend explicitly on this fiducial background metric, which is going to be responsible for breaking the diffeomorphism invariance. But if we think of this just from the effective field theory point of view, again, we're just trying to construct, starting with a massive graviton, we're trying to construct the interactions to raise the cutoff as far as possible, but we're going to demand that the two derivative interactions sum up into its Einstein-Hilbert form. Yes?
Here, all you need is the background to be non-dynamical, or does it have to be flat?
I'm going to talk about it being flat, but the final theory will admit any metric you like. It can be non-flat and non-dynamical, or it can be dynamical. There will be bimetric versions that allow the second metric to be dynamical. Okay, so we can start just by writing down, the most general possible potential. So at quadratic order, we're going to demand that it have the Fierts-Pauli structure. So here, these square brackets are going to denote H tensors, which are traced using the flat metric, like so, because we're thinking of building this up from flat space. And H squared, similarly, is everything's just traced up and contracted. All the indices are raised with the flat metric, and everything's traced with respect to the flat metric. And then we just add all possible interaction terms with all possible tensor structures. And we're going to do the same thing as before, where we ask what is the highest cutoff we can achieve.
You still don't have any dynamical sources there.
That's right, yeah, I haven't considered sources. But in fact, nothing I say is going to depend on, you could add a source as long as it's minimally coupled to this G, nothing I say will change.
Meaning that the square root of G times L, if you have, let's say you have the standard model,
yeah,
the
yeah.
Square root of G times L won't change it.
That's right, yeah. As long as it's diff invariant minimally coupled to the matter. Okay, let me say a few more things now about the Boulware-Deser ghost in the full nonlinear context. So there was this paper by Boulware and Deser in the early 70s. And the claim of this paper was that you can never have a satisfactory mass of gravity because no matter what interaction terms you pick, the full theory is always going to have 6 degrees of freedom rather than 5. So to do this, they looked essentially at an ADM decomposition, where you take the metric and you break it up in the usual way in terms of lapse and shift. So this is just the nonlinear version of breaking up into H00 and H0J like we did for the linear case. And if you use this parameterization in the Einstein-Hilbert-Lagrangian, so you pass to the Hamiltonian by doing a Legendre transform with respect to only the spatial components of the metric. And then the Lagrangian can be written in its equivalent first-order Hamiltonian form as something which is linear in this lapse variable. So lapse times some function of the g's and the canonical momenta plus something which is linear in the shift. So for gr, this is it. The lapse and the shift both are linear, and they enforce constraints which are responsible for the diffeomorphism invariance of the full theory. And the claim in this paper was that whatever interactions terms you add, if you add a generic interaction term, the potential doesn't have any time derivative. So it's, you never have to worry about time derivatives of the lapse and shift entering. The canonical momenta, the definition remains the same. What you add now are terms, some potential terms, which depend on the lapse and the shift and the spatial metric, which are no longer, in general, linear in the lapse and the shift. So you spoil the Lagrange multiplierness of these lapse and shifts. They are now just algebraically determined. If you algebraically determine them and plug them back in, you get some Hamiltonian. But you.
What is n again?
N is this 0,0 component of the metric in the ADM variables.
So this is just by definition. This is what you choose to.
Yeah, this is the standard ADM parameterization of the metric. So it's the. It's the cleanest way to arrive at the Hamiltonian of the theory. It's just, you can think of it just as a change of variables. Right, so in the generic case, this is no longer linear in the lapse and shift. So when we plug back, we just get some Hamiltonian, but we get no constraints. So in terms of the phase space, the spatial metric has 6 components. It's a symmetric spatial tensor. The canonical momentum also has 6 components for a total of 12. But there's no constraints on the phase space, so the phase space is actually 12-dimensional, which is right for describing 6 degrees of freedom, which is the mass of graviton plus this extra scalar, which is the Boulware-Deser ghost. So this sort of killed interest in the possibility of massive gravitons for 40 years, because it was assumed that this would just always happen. But when you actually look more careful at their paper, they didn't consider every possible mass term. They just considered the sort of convenient ones that were easy to analyze, but it was sort of became entrenched as a no-go theorem, even though it wasn't actually a complete no-go theorem. So we'll see that the DRGT theory actually gets around this, and that there is a specific choice of potential for which everything is still linear in a suitably redefined lapse variable. That's right. So there's going to be one constraint, which will then generate a secondary constraint and will form a second class set, which eliminates the sixth degree of freedom.
So where does the constraint come from? It's just imposed?
You'll see. It comes out automatically when we demand that we have this higher cutoff.
I see.
So just like in
by doing this exercise,
that's right.
You just climb it out.
That's right. So the analog in the toy theory that we just saw was that when we demanded this lambda 3 cutoff, the potential came out in such a form that it was still linear in H 0, 0. So an analogous thing is going to happen in the full nonlinear case as well. Okay, so to see all this, we again have to do the Stueckelberg trick. That's the most convenient way, the way to see it. But we now have to be a little more sophisticated because we have to restore not just the linearized diffeomorphism symmetry of the linear term, but the full diffeomorphism symmetry of the full Einstein-Hilbert term. Okay, so to do this, it's going to be convenient for me to reorganize this general possible potential in a slightly different way. So instead of using the flat fiducial metric to raise and lower these indices, I want to use the full metric to raise and lower indices. So I'm going to write the potential now as using these angly brackets. So these angly brackets are H raised and lowered with the full metric now. And all traces with respect to the full metric. So now there's some, I write just a general combination again with some coefficients which are now different than the original ones. Okay, so this is no loss of generality. It's just a rewriting of that potential because given this form of the potential, I can always just expand the full metric around the flat background in powers of H. Expand it, recollect everything, and get back to that form. So it's just a rewriting of the most general potential. But it's going to be a convenient one for introducing this Stueckelberg trick. Okay, so the full diff invariance that we have to restore is invariance under the coordinate shifting to any function of the coordinates. So the metric under this change transforms like so. So the Einstein-Hilbert term has this symmetry. The mass term breaks it. We want to introduce new fields into the mass term such that we, again, have this symmetry. OK, so we do this by introducing four new scalars. Let's see, we're almost out of time, and this is a good stopping point. So I think we will pick this up the next time.
You have a colloquium from Wednesday. Do you want to do it after that?
Well, I think I already have it prepared, so we can do it Wednesday. I don't know.
Okay.
Okay.
It's for you.
Okay.
Okay, Wednesday, same time.
Wednesday, same time? Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
I missed this. You are playing with the hybrid brackets.
I know, this is...
So the angly brackets were raising and lowering with the full metric. You can take that full metric and just expand it in powers of h, and then you'll get back to something that's been raised using the flat metric.
Seems like
Thank you.